Welcome to Profiling Criminal Minds. I'm Dan.
And I'm Dr. Redmond.
And, well, we made it to the end of season 11, which is bittersweet, because this is basically it for Thomas Gibson on the show. We're going to say a bigger farewell to him when he actually leaves next year, but suffice to say, it's pretty heartbreaking, because he has been consistently the central grounding element of the show.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of their strongest actors, but more importantly, like, he really understands how important the character he's playing is at centering the emotions of everybody and centering this world.
Yeah.
And let's just say that nothing good happens after he leaves. You need that energy. You need that energy, people. And Emily Prentice ain't that energy. But that's not what we're here to talk about today. Let's get right to it. The storm.
When Hotch finds himself arrested and accused of masterminding a terrorist attack by the Department of Justice, the remaining members of the BAU juggles clearing his name and identifying the people responsible for framing him. First of all, Juggles should not have... Well, never mind.
Yeah.
never mind. I'm not going to do the grammar thing.
No, it's fine. Yeah. Oh, my God.
You see, the verb... Actually, I have to do it. I have
okay,
to.
Okay, please.
I have to. The juggle is not attached to BAU, which having the S would make sense. No, this is the problem of a... What do we call it? A noun verb. The noun and the verb have to have the same tense. So it's members. The remaining members, bracket of the BAU, juggle clearing. The members and juggles are the two that have to match, not BAU. That is part of a phrase that explains who the members are part of. Yeah, you can tell I'm not going to be teaching for 3 weeks.
Right? You got to get it out somewhere. I completely
somewhere,
get it.
Right?
In case you didn't hear last week's episode, we are right now in the middle of a coronavirus lockdown in Canada.
Yeah.
So our accomplished doctor here is going stir crazy from not being able to teach English. Because she teaches English 5 days a week to a bunch of people who are doing great at English, but... And if you're doing something 15, 20 hours a week and you suddenly being told you can't do it anymore, you got to put that energy somewhere. And it's going to be correcting my grammar for the foreseeable future.
Oh, hey, but here, you want to know what's worse, though,
is that?
Because I'm teaching the film history course, right? Or the film and history course.
Yeah.
Right.
I had to,
because I'm not teaching for 3 weeks, the next 3 weeks, I've had to. Literally, I have three classes left, right? So there's the major S lecture that's going to kind of pull the class and give this overview of the class that there's no way I am going to write out a three-hour lecture or a two-and-a-half-hour lecture.
Do a speech and put it on YouTube or do it over Skype.
Oh, whatever.
No, that would be insane.
Give me a break. They don't pay me enough. I work part-time at the university. They don't pay me enough to do all of that. If I was working full-time, I'd say, yeah, well, I guess I better. But I'm not. but it is the film course. Right?
Yeah, but honestly, at that point,
and
just
so
read
now
a book
I've had to. Okay. But now I've had to then also the next, like, and then we were also going to watch Matawan.
Ah.
About the union, about the union stuff in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the process of the violence of unionization.
Yeah.
And then we were going to look at Harlan County.
Yeah. Both very good stories. Harlan County, USA, and Matawan. Both very good stories about the fight for unionization and how much money likes to kill poor people when money is threatened.
Well, and the corruption of the union.
Oh,
in
yeah.
Harlan County, USA, and then I'm not going to be able to show the clips from that segment of Justified about, you know, when the mining company comes back into town and the relationship between sort of drugs and the loss of the main income, which is in mining.
I guess what we're trying to say is, if you notice, we're even more digressive than normal for the next 6 episodes. There's a good reason for it. She's got to teach somewhere, and it might wind up being here.
Anyway, and the other thing that I just want to say is, and I won't be able to make my class listen to Harlan County, but Brad Paisley does a wonderful job of Harlan County.
Yeah.
As and then I would make them listen to a couple of other people, including the guy that wrote Harlan County, which is Loudermilk?
I think it's Loudermilk.
Yeah. Huh. Okay, so, and there's a really nice YouTube video of him doing some kind of a radio show, I think, and talking about his, there's a lot of confusion around, oh no, that's not, that's, excuse me, no, it's not Loudermilk, Harlan County, never mind. I was going to go on to, I was talking about Cherokee Nation.
Okay. All right, so let's get into this episode after that amazing digression. Thank you so much for that. I hope everyone didn't just skip ahead jamming on that 30 seconds forward button 6 times until you hear me say the words criminal minds. But if you did, criminal minds. Seriously, though, I will stop joking around.
So, okay, what else are you going to do with this episode?
What else am I going to do with this episode? This crazy episode. Seriously, it opens with him being arrested. And it's this really insane thing where I always talk about, like, how people in fiction don't know how to plan, you know, crimes at all. Because all of the, like, every single part of the Nazis' plan would have worked if they hadn't had Aaron arrested before they did their plan.
Yeah.
Every single part of it would have worked. They had Nazis throughout these prisons. They had explosives. They were, like, ready to blow up a bunch of government buildings and spring all their friends from prison in one day. And they screwed it all up and the weird part is, like, well, it was that important to frame Aaron because the Nazi really hated Aaron. Yeah, you know what? You can frame him the day after you sprung everyone from prison.
And you've done the blow up.
Yeah, you've done the blow up. Because you've done all of this stuff by framing him for buying the explosives, right? Well, that frame works after the explosion, too. Maybe better.
Maybe better. But maybe what we have to say is that they think Aaron is so brilliant that if they don't frame him ahead of time and get him out of the unit,
he'll somehow magically stop a thing he had no idea was happening.
Just because Francis Fisher
said a storm is coming.
Slade said a storm is coming.
And so, by the way, that is in this episode, they try to retroactively suggest that Francis Fisher's plan had something to do with all of this. But
it doesn't.
It doesn't. It had nothing. It had nothing to do with it. And she only knows about this because, by an absurd coincidence, her son is the guy who, again, completely coincidentally, was hired by a bunch of Nazis to frame Aaron. But, like, that is her only involvement in any of this.
Okay,
that, in a total coincidence, her son, a pretty good computer guy who is autistic, right? He's pretty good with computers, he is autistic, and he got hired by some Nazis to do this. But that is her only connection to the situation, and it's kind of ridiculous that it worked out that way. Like, how?
I mean, how does she even know where her son is?
Okay, we have to imagine, actually, the one thing that does make sense is, well, I'll tell you the one thing that makes sense. If her son is a moderately well-known hacker,
mm-hmm,
that would explain how she learned C++ to do the various coded messages. right?
Okay, that's not my issue.
Oh, no, but I'm just saying, and it's like, so presumably they've been in constant touch with the C++ messages.
No, what I'm trying to say is, I thought he was taken away from her.
He was.
And raised by somebody else.
How did she ever find him or he find her? Yeah, I have no idea.
That's my issue is.
You're right. And that is a much bigger issue, actually.
Unless the child was the child wasn't adopted by some family that her father knew. So
he was just parceled off somewhere.
How did they ever connect? Because he's autistic and actually quite autistic. He's obviously a computer savant.
Yeah, he's decent with computers, but he is completely incapable of most kinds of social interaction.
So the idea that he would even go looking for her, or she would go, and she's been in jail. So yeah. Anyway, I don't know. It wasn't explained, but that was the first thing I was going. Once we met him, it explains why she was so worried about him.
Yeah.
And she didn't want him to be killed.
Yeah.
Okay, but I mean, and then that scene, that friggin' scene with JJ. Oh, Lord, JJ, of course you've killed people that had nothing to do with family.
I know. Don't get me started on that.
You know, I want to give a great big huge raspberry 6 million times while I'm watching it.
I agree. Like, you're completely right about it. But hey, if JJ wasn't completely self-deluded, she wouldn't be JJ.
That's true. That's like, true. Yes.
She would be a completely different character if she had the slightest idea why she does the things she does.
She does, yeah. Okay, so let me tell you, we'll talk commentary whenever something comes up when we're talking.
Oh, please, get into it.
Go in. Okay, so it turned out, Breen Fraser, the commentary is by Erica Messer and Breen Fraser. And
man or woman? I've never known based on the name.
Man.
Okay. I've never heard that name before, so.
No, neither have I, but no, it's Fraser, like in Fraser Crane.
Well, yeah, I know that. It's the Breen I was having trouble with.
You have no idea. It's a man. Okay. And he did a very nice, he did that really nice commentary with Shamar Moore.
You told me about that on the Derek episode. Yeah.
Yeah, and we talked about
about how Breen Fraser was all like did a lot of work developing the Derek Morgan character. Yes. Yeah, we talked about that a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, he'd been developing Morgan from the beginning. Now,
okay.
So he was talking about when he first put together when he was writing the script and he was putting it together, and he initially had all members of the team, what's the word they use? Spoofed?
Swatted.
Swatted, that's it.
Yeah.
Swatted, never mind. That he had originally, and then he starts talking about the writer's room and how when he brought it into the writer's room, they all told him that you couldn't do that. First of all, if everybody got spoofed, it would take too long. Swatted, and then when you come to the last one, which is Hotch, right, then it loses its power.
Yes.
And he was just giving, and this is why we have a writing team. He was talking about the writing team, right, about how.
Yeah, and he's, the team was absolutely right.
What he says.
Yeah.
It's exactly what he says. He said, thank heavens for the team, you know. Yeah. And he's going on about that with this. Yes. So, we could have had a really rotten episode.
I mean, we still have a pretty bad episode, but it could have been absolute trash.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yeah, so because the idea that it's
Erica,
like
Erica and Breen wrote it.
Oh, okay. And the thing is, right, when you watch the when you hear that story, you're like, well, yeah, it's barely plausible that the FBI could have suspected Hotch the way they do. But the idea that they could have suspected the entire team was involved in a conspiracy against the United States of America.
Government? Yeah, no, I don't think so.
Of course that could. That's just completely, like, it is laugh out loud funny that they could have believed that. And I'm glad that the writing room thought better of it. because oof, that would have been embarrassing. Yeah. And it's funny because they want to say something about swatting in this episode, which is a real thing and a real problem. It's where, you know, you say, yeah. Oh my God, there's a hostage situation at so-and-so's house. And then you know, they come in and they hopefully shoot the guy. Well, I mean, obviously you don't want them to shoot the guy, but in this situation, they were hoping they would shoot the guy. I think in most people just think, well, we hope it will inconvenience and humiliate someone. That's why it happens in the video gaming community so much. Right. But in real life, obviously it often frequently has terrible consequences.
Yeah.
Especially if they're going to a non-white person's house, but that's a whole other conversation about the American police. What's funny though, is when I'm watching the episode, you get, so they want to say something about swatting. So they talk about the psychology of swatting and what type of person does it. And then they get very puzzled because they're like, but this guy doesn't fit the profile of a swatter. How could he be the guy? And I'm like, dear morons, you seem to not understand that there is, I need to burn down a building to collect insurance, right? And then imagine how stupid it would be if someone looked, he did profit by the thing burning down, but he doesn't have the normal sexual dysfunction we find in arsonists. So he can't be the guy because he doesn't fit the profile of an arsonist. Like, no, the reason he doesn't fit the profile is because he didn't do this for fun. He did it because someone paid him to do it. You absolute morons. Like, it's like saying, this guy killed 12 people. While he was in the Second World War. But when he was a child, he didn't hurt small animals, wet the bed, or start fires. So he doesn't profile like a mass murderer. It was his job!
Yeah.
But it's like they actually say this out loud. But this isn't an episode about swatting. It's an episode about a conspiracy by white supremacists to blow up government buildings and frame Thomas Gibson's character, Aaron Hotchner. That's a completely different thing. So why are you talking about profiles? Profiles are irrelevant. Evidence is all that matters right now. Oh, that line. I know it's like three lines, but it bothers me so much when they start talking about profiles. Profiles are not relevant to your current situation. You know who did it. Oh, God. But yeah, the fact that, like, and although I say they will get this right away, which is very smart. They do realize, well, that the only conceivable way that she could have known that Hotch was going to be attacked was that she knew the person who did it.
Yes.
And literally the only contact she could conceivably have would be her son. So it's like, that is a completely logical step-by-step solve that I have no trouble with at all. It beggars belief that coincidentally her son is the guy they hired to do this. And your point that why on earth, like how on earth would her son be in contact with her, are both completely accurate. But from a fundamental standpoint, I do believe that once you have this weird thing that this serial killer knows about a Nazi conspiracy to blow up a bunch of buildings, or in that at this point of the story, just frame Hotch.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, obviously she would have to be in touch with it. The only person who would have told her about it was her son, since it's not like she has any friends. So, yeah, no. Like, I completely follow the logic, and I found all of that completely believable. Yeah, yeah. Like 100%. I got no complaints about that part of the story at all.
Yeah, and you have
the last part of the story I have no complaints about.
Yes. Well, they had a nice little scene there with Spencer Reed and...
And her.
No, and the
boy. Not in her, and the boy, yeah.
And the son.
Yeah, no, that was so nice, because he understands how to cope with this kind of
thing. Yes, and he was the one that came in and calmed everything down. And
yeah, he understands the symptoms. He understands that you can't, like, that yelling at this person to put a gun down, which is...
Isn't going to help.
Isn't
going
to get the job done, even though that's all SWAT teams know how to do.
Oh, yes, and then in the commentary, right, Erica Messer mentions, yes, well, you know, yeah, well, you know, we sort of were thinking that maybe that Spencer Reed was you know, autistic in the beginnings of this thing. And then we changed our minds, and I'm going, you know, and then it turns out that was a misdiagnosis. And I'm sitting here going, did we ever get told it was a misdiagnosis?
No, I don't think we ever got told.
We ever got told. Maybe you guys knew it was a misdiagnosis. I don't think you told your audience.
No.
So we didn't understand how come Reed They're became a human like... being again.
I know. Well, no, but I mean, we've talked before about how obviously Reed, like, is just the product of abuse. He does not have, he has none of the traits of autistic people. He's just a very smart kid with an amazing memory who was horribly abused his entire childhood and had all sorts of, you know, social dysfunction from being isolated from other people by his mother's insanity and his own intellect. Like, he's got a lot of emotional problems, but he does not have any kind of a real behavioral disorder. You know, he is not on the autism spectrum at all. But yeah,
it's very interesting. It is interesting. And I was listening to this and going, but did you ever tell us?
I know.
That? Because no, it's clear.
Yeah, it is completely clear from the way he plays it, from the way he's written, all of that, that he's not anymore.
Yeah, that it, but at the beginning, they kind of treated it like that.
Oh,
so
they absolutely did.
So I'm going.
You're right. I think they maybe just never communicated that to the audience.
No, never.
Yeah, I think
I'm convinced that they've never ever told us, because I am sure that as we were building Meta Reed, that we would have brought that up.
That in, had they, you know, given us that information. Yeah. So you get a good scene with him, and then he just says who did it. And then the son just says, oh, it's these white supremacists. And then Hotch. Hotch is like, well, obviously he's planning a jailbreak, which is a completely reasonable thing to think in that situation. Mm-hmm. But it raises the big question, which is, and now we're going to get into this, do you believe that Aaron wouldn't have told them that he was drugged by Mr. Scratch?
I do not believe that.
Okay, good. I didn't believe it either.
Not for 1 minute.
No.
For God's sake, he told them that he would have killed.
Yeah. What's he admitted to them that he would have killed
Hayden.
Yeah.
If he hadn't been stopped.
Yeah.
That he couldn't stop himself and he would have killed him.
Yeah. Right? They were willing.
Why wouldn't he tell him?
Yeah. Would he not? And again, they found him in a drugged out stupor.
Yeah, so...
Did everybody leave that out of their reports?
I don't.
Was there a conspiracy to leave this information out of the reports?
I'm trying to think back, you know. I'm sitting here going, I can't believe...
No.
But I'd have to go back and actually look at the after... And whether they all, maybe they all conspired to leave that out of their reports, but there's no reason
that this character, for everything we know about this character, there's no reason to believe that he would have covered up the fact that he had been drugged by a crazy murderer.
Well, because they all knew he was, and there was more people than just the team that rescued him. There was a whole stack of people.
He was treated by EMT people afterwards. He's literally the last shot of the episode is him in an ambulance telling Derek what happened.
Yeah. So.
So there's no way.
That wouldn't have been in his report. I don't.
Okay, good. I'm glad you agree with me. But the weird part is, I'd be fine with them criticizing him alone for all the time he covers up for his team.
Yeah.
You know? He shouldn't be covering up for them. And they point out how crazy it is that he, that he covered for David when he wouldn't cover for Al.
Yeah.
You know? And that's an interesting point that, you know, David went to get personal revenge and he covered up for David, But he didn't cover up for Elle when she got personal revenge. And is that just because he also wanted the guy who killed Gideon dead? You know?
Well, I think that, that could factor in, but it could also be the fact that Elle was just new to the team.
Yeah.
And she wasn't part of the team, and she didn't behave the way she should have behaved. And there's other things, whereas for, and then you add that to the fact that David Rossi, of course, is the man who
helped founded the team. So yeah, he gets that
and
extra credit.
He has that cachet, and he has that a semi-hero worship attached to him.
So yeah, it's not just Aaron giving him a pass. The whole FBI is giving him a pass.
Everybody gives David Rossi a friggin' pass.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
That's actually very true.
You know, they can do what he wants.
Yeah.
He's the man who founded the unit.
Yeah, so he pretty much has carte blanche to do whatever he wants.
And remember, he's famous now.
Best-selling author. He's got plenty of money. Thing. So yeah, you're right. Okay. It's silly for me to even question that for a second.
So that he would, after all of that, and he'd become world famous and everything else, he still wanted to come back to the FBI.
Of course, we love him. Of course we're going to take him back. Yeah, you're right. And so he kills one crazy serial killer. Boo-hoo. Yeah. Who hasn't wanted to kill a crazy serial killer?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. You make a strong point there. But whereas no, L. Yeah.
Whereas L's... Elle's behavior was in many ways.
It absolutely was.
And basically, yes, he sort of gave her a pass because she was only just there. I mean, ultimately, David Rossi knew what he was doing when he did it. And they all knew what he was doing when he did it. Whereas.
Except for Kristen Vangsness.
Yeah, well, you know. But she's his choice, so, I don't mean that in any negative way, but she is.
She sees the best in everybody all the time. That's not a criticism.
No. But what I was going to say is, whereas Elle sort of did other things, and Hotch didn't kick her out.
No.
I mean, it's not like
he
Hotch,
let her resign, yeah.
And the rest of it. So, you know, I mean, it was sort of, well, he did tell her that she had to do all of this stuff and this stuff and this stuff. And then she just walked away.
Yeah. He also said what I found to be the most ridiculous thing he's ever said, that he would put her in jail if he could prove that she executed guy.
Like, yeah, no, I know. You wouldn't. Yeah.
You're the FBI. You don't put FBI agents
as
in jail.
As we found out in the ensuing years of the BAU.
No, they'll cover up for anybody for anything. But the thing is, he does cover up. I do question why it was such a problem that he faked Emily Prentice's death. Like, well, I don't see that as being a big problem. Like, I mean,
don't think. Yeah, yeah. Why would anybody see that as a problem? The CIA rubber stamped it.
Yeah, like they got help from CIA. Big parts of the federal government. To do this, it was completely fine. She was an asset beloved by the State Department, you know.
Now,
and it's fine that they faked her death. Please.
Maybe this guy didn't know the whole story.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
that's true. But maybe a bunch of it is classified. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, maybe a whole bunch of it is classified, and therefore nobody really knows what we want. Because they have to cover up for Emily when she finally kills What's-His-Face.
Yeah. Okay. Well, no, she didn't kill anybody. She was just there when
Ian
Doyle thing went down and a bunch of people got, and all of their suspects got shot, so they weren't able to. It was her fault, but yes.
Okay, but yeah, do you know what I mean? I mean, it would be classified. It would be CIA classified stuff.
Oh, totally.
So it's quite possible that this guy may not have the clearance to know about
some of that stuff. Okay, yeah. Actually, you make a strong point there.
Yeah.
Oh man, but it's a what do you call it?
He probably hates the BAU and hates
anyway.
Hot. So he
yeah,
was
you're
lying.
Right. It's interior. It's intra. Right. It's intra FBI squabbles.
And
is what it is.
Why would you believe Mr. Scratch?
Yeah, that's the insane part that you would believe yeah. Mr. Scratch is
unless you really, really, really
have it into
had yeah. it in for Hotch.
And yeah, that's the thing. Unless you have 100%, you were just looking for an excuse to get this guy. Yeah. The idea that you would believe Mr. Scratch for a second is ridiculous. Yeah. Yeah, okay, you make a strong point there. But yeah, so fundamentally, we don't believe, like, maybe this guy is out to get Hotch for political reasons, but yeah. fundamentally, we cannot believe he wouldn't have put that he was drugged in the report.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no way, based on everything we know about Hotch.
Oh,
and I don't believe the line.
Yeah, you don't believe the line.
No, you just don't believe that line. And honestly, like you said, he does enough, like, there are enough issues with politics inside the FBI that it could be believable that someone would be out to get him. And honestly, what? He does enough shady stuff that there's reason to go after him. So
for sure.
You put all that together and they didn't need this extra bit where he lied about what happened when they arrested Mr. Scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And you just don't need that extra bit. All right, so let's move on to the actual prison raid, where they're the only, like, I love what a tiny response to a prison raid it is.
Well, you know, they had to cut the budget somewhere.
I know. But it's, like, literally just, like, their team and four SWAT guys, and then a couple more guys outside.
Yeah, and, but all the rest of the guys were in different prisons. As it turns
well, actually,
out.
No, it
no, they
out
weren't.
They're
That's
not
right.
because
they
all of the other prison breaks work.
Yeah.
So yeah, they figure out, okay, well, obviously this guy's going to be trying to break out, right? So let's go and let's lock him down. So they rush over, and meanwhile, they're, you know, Nazi hackers who have infiltrated the prisons go and they open up all the doors, and there's full on riots, and then we get a couple of bizarre scenes. One where they where you get some guys had tunneled out. It's like, it's weird that they had two escape plans going on simultaneously, and neither of them were great because the escape both all of their escape plans involved causing a riot to happen. And I'm like, you don't think the cops are going to come encircle the place when a riot has happened? Because their plan was just, like, tunnel out and walk away from the prison. Well, yeah, but whether or not the BAU figured out what was going on, the minute you triggered that riot and opened up all the doors, the state cops are going to rush the place and completely surround it. So that part was not a good plan at all. And the second half was the whole thing where they get dressed up in guards' clothing and they pretend
the
guards
SWAT
are going to shoot
teams.
Them. And then the SWAT, and they're like, and then you get this ridiculous idea because, okay, and I don't know how to describe this. They want to surprise the audience so much that they forget about the logic of the situation, right? Which is, and tell me if this isn't, like, if I'm not thinking about this right or if this is unclear. They forget about the logic of the situation, which is the two guys in prisoner uniforms who are holding guns, they know that the plan is to have the SWAT team bust in and shoot them, and the other guys escape pretending to be cops. Like, they know that that's what the plan is. They know that they're about to be murdered. And yet, when the SWAT team busts down the door, they don't immediately drop the guns and scream, "We're cops, shoot them." They turn and they lift their guns like they're surprised that this is happening. But this is exactly what's supposed to happen. Like, they can't, the moment before the door gets kicked open, if they try to do anything, they'll be shot by the convicts on the floor. And if they wait too long after the door opens, right, the SWAT team is going to misunderstand the situation and get shot, which is what happens. But they don't, so they all have to know that their only chance of surviving, their only conceivable chance of surviving is to minute the SWAT team arrives, drop the guns, throw themselves to the floor. That's their only chance of surviving. But they don't do that, and I don't I just don't believe it. I don't believe that they wouldn't, that these men wouldn't take their only chance at survival.
Yeah. Because they, yeah, all of these guys, you know, are trained.
Yeah.
They've for all this. Been
trained for what to do in riots.
Yeah. So it's like, they all know the chances of them being misidentified and shot as collateral damage.
Especially because they've been forced to, I mean, like, hostages get shot all of the time in riots, even when the hostages haven't been forced to pick up guns and put on prison uniforms and pretend to be prisoners.
Yeah.
So it's like, at the best of times, there's a good chance, as a hostage, you're going to get shot in a prison riot. So all of this extra stuff has been done to ensure that you get shot. And so they're literally, their only chance of getting this out of this alive is to drop their guns and throw themselves to the floor the minute the SWAT team shows up.
Yeah.
But they don't do that, and they act like they're surprised that the SWAT team is kicking open the door. But, like, that was the criminal's whole plan. And obviously you know it's the plan, because you spent 5 minutes changing clothes with the prisoners and picking up empty assault rifles.
Yeah.
So you know that the plan is to kill you, so why are you helping with the plan? Yeah, that part really bothered me. And then they get caught immediately, so it ends up not mattering. And you get Tara having a showdown with the murderer from the start of the season.
Oh, wasn't that cute?
Wasn't it?
Wasn't that cute?
Yeah, I get that little showdown. I'm like, oh, God, is she going to kill him? She doesn't kill him, though. Which, you know, it would have been great growth for her character. It would have sent her down an interesting road as she killed the guy who she was obsessed with, who she blew up her relationship
marriage
over. Yeah, it was her fiancé. Blew up her engagement over because she was so fascinated with this guy and their similarities, right? And it's like to actually cut the, like, again, this is not just meta. Tara Lewis, right? This is not just meta Tara Lewis, right? This is also the road we would have liked the show to go down. Imagine if she's got to kill this guy to save herself, and she has done this weird thing where she metaphorically is cutting the cord with the fantasy that she is that her urges are completely separate and contained within this guy she's obsessed with, right? She's obsessed with studying because she sees so much of herself in him. Well, the moment you actually kill that guy, even though it's to save yourself, on some level you have to wonder, did I want to kill him like I wanted to kill those other people? And by killing him, and am I admitting that I'm just like him? And that's a whole other area that this show never intended to go down, obviously.
Oh, no.
Wouldn't that have been fascinating?
Oh. Well, no, I...
this guy?
Right from the beginning, yeah.
Yeah. Like, that's such an interesting...
She was saved by the bell.
Yes.
The
She never had to confront that aspect of herself, because the cavalry sweeps in and saves the day, so she never has to make a hard choice.
Yeah.
Which is disappointing. It's pretty disappointing, actually.
Yeah.
So yes, let's get on to the grand finale, where they, without trouble, immediately stop a terrorist activity in like 3 minutes.
But I tell you, that helicopter blowing up looks great.
Oh, it's fun. It looked fantastic. I'm not going to criticize that part. I'm not delusional. It's hilarious. But you see my issue with that scene, which is literally, so they capture the Nazis, and then Aaron's like, okay, you're a Nazi. I know that your guys have your Nazi group, which they keep calling a fundamentalist group. I'm like, no, they're white supremacists. Fundamentalist is a different thing that has a very different meaning, right? And, I mean, this isn't as bad as that time that JJ said they were looking into fundamental groups, and no one noticed, and they left it in the episode. But it's still pretty bad that they keep calling, like, no, they're militia guys. They're, you know, They're guys who want their own state. They're guys who don't believe in the ability of the federal government to levy taxes. They're Nazis, you know? And, the you know, it's not a coincidence that they're all white guys. Come on. But anyway, what I love is that, like, how easily they wrap this up, because the minute they know that it's all a plan by him, like, this guy, then immediately Aaron's like, well, we know for a fact that your group has only 3 hideouts, so which of those 3 hideouts are they in? And he just waits for him to have a reaction. He's like, okay, that's the hideout they're in. And then they go to the hideout and they shoot everybody. And that's the end of the episode. Like, it wraps up weirdly quickly, I would argue. Is it so easy? But, I mean, as you said, we have a fun scene of them shooting down a helicopter.
I know, it was fun. It was wonderful, the action scene with the helicopter.
But what I would argue is, once you know that it's his white supremacist group who's behind all of this, and you know that they only have 3 hideouts, maybe don't wait until you've stopped the prison break. Maybe send the state cops and the National Guard out to those 3 hideouts. Like, why are you waiting until everything else has been sorted out before you, like, we've got to foil the thing, and then we've got to stop the attack. I'm like, you know, there are more cops than just you 8 people. You can do both at once. But then it wouldn't be Criminal Minds, right?
I mean, ultimately, what else do you say, right? Yeah. I found the whole thing. I have a question, though.
Please.
And maybe I just missed something.
Okay.
But how did Mr. Scratch get away?
He was just in one of the other prisons that the...
Well, then why were they in that prison?
They were in that prison because that's where the leader of the white supremacists were. And that's where the leader of the white supremacists was held, okay? All right? I know it's a little confusing based on the end of the episode, right? So there was, there was a plan to take down Hotchner and break that leader of the white supremacists out of jail. And then that night, frame Hotchner for blowing up some government building, right? Okay, so that was the plan. And somehow they got in touch with Mr. Scratch and told him, we're taking down this Hotchner guy, we know you hate him, so, you know, tell a bunch of lies about him being a scumbag. And as a payoff for that, we're going to be breaking a bunch of our skinhead friends other prisons. Yes, and you can come with them when we break them out, when we do our big 3-prison or 4-prison break all at the same time, right? And that is how Mr. Scratch gets out, because the other 3 prison breaks go fine. Like, the other 3 Nazi prison breaks go fine, and that is how Mr. Scratch escapes. Okay, so I know it's a little confusing, because you're like, why isn't Mr. Scratch? Because they specifically say, oh, we're going to the jail with the wing that has every serial killer in it. And it's like, shouldn't Mr. Scratch be there then? But no, he was in a completely different prison and they were able to spring it. Please, you were going to say?
No, I was just confused.
Because?
Why did they go to that prison break?
Well,
if nothing to do with Mr.
How do you mean? Who are you talking about in this situation?
Okay, first of all, I'm talking about the...
The team, the our, Nazis?
The
who?
Team. Yeah. The team. Why did they show up at that prison?
Because they know that... What do you call... because... I know, you think that they would go to the prison that Mr. Scratch is in and assume he's going to be sprung. I understand why you think that. The reason they go to that prison is because Aaron's profile is that the guy who's in charge of this Nazi, white supremacist, you know, whatever organization, Freemen organization, right, is so, like, obsessed with his own, like, he wants to break out of jail, obviously. So he needs to, he wants to be out for the bombing, not to just be like behind bars while a bombing happens. So he knows right away that they're going to try to spring him when they also are doing the bombing. So, and it's possible that the son that we're forgetting and the son also said something about the prisons, but I could be wrong about that. They might just be going because they know what kind of guy the head white supremacist is. It's entirely possible that's the only reason they go there. But, and this is where they don't think for a second that they're going to be doing simultaneous prison breaks at a bunch of other prisons. Because he knows that a bomb is going to go off, and he knows that this guy is going to want to be there for the bomb going off, so it's logical to assume they're going to break him out of prison. It's possible we're forgetting a line of dialogue with the son where he also suggested the prison break, and it isn't just based on psychology, but yeah, they did have reason to go and stop the prison break. And the confusing thing is, why isn't Mr. Scratch? Because you think, oh, it's got to be related to Mr. Scratch wanting to get out of jail. That's why they go to the prison. But no, it's not related to Mr. Scratch wanting to get out of jail. That is coincidental and happens at a different prison the same night. It's needlessly confusing. I agree. I agree with you. So let's get to the last scene where they're having a party to introduce Hayden to the lives of the rest of the team. This will also be her last appearance on the show, so thanks for that. And hey, Junior's there. Will's here for the episode.
I know, wasn't that nice?
It's always great to see him. We've been very open about our love for Josh Stewart on the show. This past week, the Josh Stewart episode, where we talk about his movies, went up. And it was happy to get a chance to really listen to that and be like, yeah, he's really good at making movies, and I hope he does more. But the point is, he's there, so they get, and then they get a phone call with the biggest cliffhanger the show has ever done. 13 serial killers that they already caught have been sprung from prison, and they're gonna have to catch them all over again. And, spoiler alert, that never pays off.
And that's really interesting, right? Because when they talk about, and when they talk
that's
about
what
it,
I have to know about this, like, do they let you in on what their idea was with that cliffhanger?
Well, they were, I mean, they thought it was a great cliffhanger and that it meant that they were going to, have this, you know, setting everything up for next year's show. And so I'm going, but what happened then? Like next year, like they really did think that this was the setup for next year's show from the way the two of them were talking about it.
Okay. So yeah. They really did plan for the first 13 episodes of the next year to be about tracking down fan favorite serial killers from previous episodes who haven't been killed.
Yeah.
Okay, so
it was the plan.
Okay, that's amazing. Because here are the two possibilities. Possibility one, they couldn't get any of the actors back that they wanted to use, so they just said screw it. That's possibility number one.
Yeah, okay.
That is a possibility. Two, and I think this is the more likely one. And this is going to sound like I'm being too mean, but bear with me for a second. I think the more likely answer is that during the break, as they were trying to write the episodes, they noticed that the only thing that makes it hard to find serial killers is that you don't know who they are. And that none of the serial killers they chase are the kind of people who would logically have the ability to disappear and into new identities and be hard to find, and none of them would be hard to catch. And fundamentally, as they were trying to beat out the season in the writing room, they noticed, you know, like, manhunting people who we already know are guilty is a completely different kind of show than the one we've been making for 11 years.
It's quite possible.
And I think they thought it sounded good to bring back the fan favorites and do this. And it's like to have, the best serial killers we've ever featured are going to show up again and blah, 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 blah. And like, you remember the guy who put a camera in the eye of his sister and gave her a lobotomy? We can have him back. Like all of the fun, flamboyant serial killers. And there are a bunch of people who they could have brought back and you could have seen again, right? Mm-hmm. Not just Mr. Scratch. But then they realized, but that isn't the show we're doing.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, that isn't the kind of show we're being paid to make. And when they realized that, they were like, oh, hell, what have we done? And so that's why when they come back at the beginning of season 12, 11 of the 13 serial killers
have already been caught
over the summer. And you know what my favorite part is?
Mm-hmm.
They say over the summer.
Yeah.
Because the people making the show have forgotten about the 6-month time jump when Derek got better. And the summer has already happened. These episodes are set in October. I know. All right. So that was season 11. I think we can both agree that Derek was the best episode of the season. Like, is there anything you're going to put over Derek?
Let me look.
Scan. Because now I have to think about what is the worst episode of the season.
As we said right at the beginning.
That's going to be so
pretty friggin' hard.
So much harder to try and figure out what the worst episode was this year. Because, woo doggy, was it a rough season for Criminal Minds. I'm going to my episode list as well. We're just going to quickly, you know, we're just going to
quickly... I don't know, I mean...
But, I mean, you can't disagree with me the best episode is Derek. Do you honestly have a pitch for a better episode than Derek this year? Okay, I will say this. Maybe Entropy. Maybe Entropy. Because the two of them, Aubrey Plaza and Matt Gubler, are so much fun together. Right?
Yeah.
It might be better. I personally would like to say Derek is the best one.
Because I think, and Breen Fraser wrote both of those.
Wow.
The two best episodes.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Breen Fraser, you know, frequently does a good job. I'll say it. Virgil Williams frequently does a good job. Like, there are good writers who work on the show.
Oh, they yeah.
Just don't often Every don't now do good and then work.
They screw up royally.
Yeah, and then Virgil Williams has the habit of writing just the most, episodes where you just don't get the morality of it at all. I mean, he wrote Outlaw this year, and you're like, we're not sad that a serial rapist is getting shot. I don't care that he's getting shot in front of his son. I don't care that he's getting shot.
No. Oh, that was just so terrible. It was the music that did that. Who the frig did that?
I know.
Anyway. That could go down as one of the worst.
Yeah, Outlaw's going to be one of the worst.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean...
Till Death Do Us Part was really bad.
I think my hesitation over Derek...
Yeah?
...as the best episode is because of the two following episodes.
Yeah, but you can't do that. Just because it doesn't pay off doesn't mean... We're just talking about the episode on its own. Like,
yeah,
that's the
thing.
I know you have a hard time separating it. I get that, but you got to give me that just as an episode. Yeah, but you say that, but like if you're going to use those rules, then Entropy has to reflect what an unbelievable disaster the entire Dark Web Hitman storyline was. You know?
Yeah, okay.
You got to play
fair.
Yeah,
but these ones were seen close together.
No, that's true. You're right. They did take a long break, and we did them together. That's true.
But, yeah, no, Derek is a good episode. I suspect, yeah, you're right. I mean, and the Danny Glover, the whole thing with his father, I think everything about it, probably a couple of little things. Like, you know,
we talked about the little things, but I think it's the best episode of this.
Yeah, and in this god-awful season.
Yeah.
At least. I mean, it stands out, and it was good. And remember, I did listen to the commentary, which you haven't done.
No, and I will, because I'm very interested to hear that. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's...
Jumped in number two.
I say Derek number one, Entropy number two.
Yeah.
Now the real prize, worst episode of the year. I have my pick, and I don't know if you can... Would you like to guess my pick, or are you just going to let me say it?
No, you can say it.
Internal Affairs. Just because every single second of that was some of the dumbest plotting the show has ever featured. every moment of that is so stupid that I consider Eternal Affairs. There's more disgusting episodes this year. There's more morally reprehensible episodes this year. But by far, just the worst episode of Criminal Minds this year is Internal Affairs, which absolutely makes, like, no single moment of it makes sense. And the fact that it's supposed to be the way they wrap up the Hitmen storyline makes it that much worse. It is just terrible from beginning to end. Do you have your own theory?
That was such a stupid episode.
It was. If you got one, go for it.
No, I was just going to go with, oh, I don't know. I think Night Watch was pretty bad.
Oh, God, the Banksy episode.
Yeah, that was really, really... I think in some ways it was worse than Internal Affairs.
For just terrible plotting, yeah.
You know, it's hard.
It's tough. I mean, it's really tough. Yeah, it's really, really tough to say what is the worst thing. All right, so we're not gonna agree on this one. I stand by Internal Affairs, but I understand why you would say the Night Watch.
It was, but there were so many. It was so many.
I know.
And it was just like, and it didn't have anything overarching. Like it didn't do what, for example, the episode Before Storm did, which is have such a powerful ending that you kind of can go, well,
at least it's fine.
In fact, you have to watch it the second time. And I had to be asked, why did you do this?
Before, I know. That's how good that ending is.
Yeah. That's how powerful the ending was. So, you know, and I didn't mind Pariahville. It was an interesting.
It was an interesting concept. It was a very interesting concept. And it asked some interesting questions and it dealt with the situation surprisingly respectfully.
Yes.
Except for the fact that, like, except for the ridiculous idea that you can have a Pariahville for no violent offenders, also no pedophiles. And I'm like, that's everything. That's everybody.
Yeah, I know.
Sex offenders or violent offenders or pedophiles. That's it. Do you just, are there 4,000 people who expose themselves to adults in America to move into this place? You have to let pedophiles into this place. I'm sorry, but you do. It's the only way this community could work. Yeah, but I mean, that's a minor problem.
It's a minor problem that you can kind of...
No, it's a surprisingly good episode, which, I mean, had a couple of plotting things and one major thing, but it's...
It's a
weirdly mature look at the subject for this show. About this incredibly complicated issue of, like, well, how do you deal with sex offenders after they've served their time?
Yeah.
Like, if we're not going to execute all sex offenders, what do we do with them when they've gone to jail? Like, and that's a really good question that the show touches on in a mature fashion. So way to go. And then, of course, the episode that could have almost been the worst episode of the year, A Beautiful Disaster.
Comes close.
It came real close. And is it the worst Matt Gubler episode?
Yes.
Yeah, you're right. Why am I even hesitating? It's obviously the worst episode that Matt Gubler has ever directed.
It's
a terrible episode.
You know, I mean, I guess it's...
And he wasn't able to... And that thing is, when you get Gubler to direct, so much of the time, he can elevate the material.
Not in this case.
Nope.
I think he was really constrained, as I said. That also has a commentary. There are... three commentaries this year.
That are very worth listening to.
They're absolutely... Well, actually, technically, the Matthew Gray Gubler one isn't worth listening to.
Because he doesn't talk.
Because he's just going, they wouldn't let me do that, and they wouldn't let me do that.
Yeah, but we did get that great story about him having to tell Lance Henriksen to blow takes until he got an honest emotional reaction out of Shamar Moore, which is a pretty funny story.
That was a funny story. That one was really funny.
It's like, I can't get an honest Dear Lance, I can't get an honest emotional reaction out of Shamar Moore. Just piss him off until he's yelling at you, please. And to his credit, the man did it.
Yeah, well, I suspect Lance Henriksen, being the professional that he is, was probably knew that there was something wrong
here. Well, no, he's a method actor. Like he trained at the Actors Studio in New York in the 70s, yeah. Like with Al Pacino and other people. So yeah, he's the real deal when it comes to acting.
Yeah,
or I guess early 80s for him, but right after Pacino was there. So yeah. It was. Oh no, I guess it was the 70s because he's in Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah, and remember that he.
Yeah,
you know?
No, so I mean, and he did that because I'm sure Pacino knew he was an Actors Studio person.
Well, let me put it this way. Just remember that Lance Henriksen learned how to read.
God, yeah, learned how to read in his 30s.
Yeah, in his 30s because he said he could no longer memorize scripts. Like,
yeah,
he was getting bigger and bigger, and he actually learned how to read. He was illiterate until he was late 20s, I think he started.
Yeah, late 20s.
Teaching himself to read.
Yeah, because he would learn by having people read the things to him. You know, because he is mildly dyslexic, and he never had the help growing up to learn to read, and he pushed himself to do it because, as you said, he was getting so much work that he actually had to learn to read.
And he couldn't, as he said, he couldn't just memorize for people talking to him. He was going to have to
learn to do it,
which is something that
actually this is a good time before we go. Let's recommend everybody check out his autobiography.
Yeah,
it's an amazing read.
Oh, it's
Meet him. I had him sign it. It's an amazing read, his autobiography.
And who did the podcast with him?
That was me. Yeah.
That was you. So
yeah, I interviewed him for the AVOD podcast, and it was great. And he's just fantastic. Like, such a cool guy. One of the few celebrities I've ever interviewed for the podcast, and he's just amazing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, no, I love Lance Henriksen. Always have ever since Aliens. Ever since Aliens.
And Terminator.
I mean, he had an amazing run of movies, but ever since Aliens, I've loved that.
Yep.
All right, so I hate to do this to everybody, but do you know what your homework is for next week?
Oh,
that's
please.
Right.
No.
It's the first three episodes of Criminal Minds Beyond Borders.
Now, you know what would be really ironic?
What's that?
Is if we started watching and decided we liked it.
Oh God, that would be amazing. Oh my God, the egg on our faces if we end up loving Criminal Minds Beyond Borders is going to be pretty severe.
And crying because
what if we find out that Beyond Borders was exactly as well written and mature as Suspect Behavior was? Because that's the thing, and it's like, Suspect Behavior, it's got just as much dumb plotting in it as Criminal Minds. But the emotional places it goes are so interesting. And all of their leads, with one exception, are so good that you don't care.
Yeah. So we'll see. Yes, we're the first three episodes of season one of Beyond Borders.
And of course, after that, we are going to be back the week after. Regular Thursday, we're going to be starting season 12, and from then on Tuesdays, we'll be doing a bonus episode where we're going to go through the rest of the series, Criminal Minds, Beyond Borders.
Beyond Borders, yes. And I should tell you one thing, though, from the commentary before we close.
Please, before we go.
It's that, for whatever reason, listening to the commentary, and Erica Messer's talking about the show.
Yeah.
And how that these are all, that the show is all self-contained. The episodes are all self-contained. And they have to be very careful if they introduce something into a character because, you know,
they want people to be able to just watch any random episode of Criminal Minds and get the full experience without having to have seen the previous episode.
And yeah, she didn't say that though.
But that's what she means.
She didn't say it that way, but that's what she means, right? Yeah. Which kind of sometimes explains things that if you want to, which means why you can sort of bring in, but, and what it would explain why you don't bother having a character Bible.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, that Breen Fraser talks about how in the one commentary, and I think I mentioned that, that he, his character to write was Derek.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering who writes specific characters then, if Breen Fraser always wrote the Derek parts.
Well, not always, but contributed to, I mean, he wouldn't have sat down and just wrote the Derek.
Well, yeah. He was in control. The way it sounded was that it was almost as if I got the impression, like after I finished listening to the commentary on the last episode, I'm going, okay, so you're starting to get an idea of how this writing room works.
Yeah.
Which means that if you have someone who is supposed to be responsible for a character.
Yeah.
Right? And of course, as I, oh no, I wouldn't have told you on the show, but Breen Fraser made this line. He said, look, in the first year, the actors are working for you.
Yeah.
And then he says, well, he said in season two and season three, usually it's a peer relationship.
Yeah.
And then he said, when you get to after that, basically the actors own the character and you're working for them. Right? Is how he put it. I mean, Erica Messer was not happy with that. And she said, and then he sort of says, well, no, I don't mean they're working, you know, but then he explains how, but they
spend so much time living with the character and you're just the writer.
And they know who the character is. And I really wonder, I don't know. So if they had assigned Breen Fraser to Shamar Moore, Derek character to at least get some continuity there. I don't know what it says about Breen Fraser that he turned this character into the one that it was, but that's okay. that's beside the point. Is it possible that Thomas Gibson had someone? I'm gonna try and check out in season 12 if I remember.
Yeah,
you know, whether.
Thomas Gibson.
There is someone who left the writing room.
Oh, see if someone who left the writing staff who he could have trusted to write for Aaron is what you're saying.
Yeah, there may have been someone who was writing for Aaron.
Yeah, well, and I think the term you're looking for the term you're looking for in the writing room, right, is and it's not that someone will come in and doctor a script for a specific character. What happens in writing rooms is various people will worry about protecting characters and protecting what a character's worldview is and making sure that it is consistent. And you're right, oftentimes it's rare that it will be assigned. It is more like that one of the writers on a big staff like this will take it upon themselves to say, I know what Derek Morgan would like. I'm the one who knows what Derek Morgan will do. So if there's a script and they will end up trusting the person to say, my instinct is that Derek Morgan would or wouldn't say X. Right. And I think what he's talking about with the relationship after like four seasons or five seasons is at a certain point, the actor should be the one who's able to say, I know what my character would or wouldn't be able to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it would be interesting to see, you're right, what if Thomas Gibson lost the person in the writing room who was there protecting Aaron's character? That's an interesting question.
Because that's what the fight was over.
Over between something him in the, and yeah, Virgil Williams. Script. All right, and so.
Yeah.
That is going to be something we're going to look into to see who left the show, see who left the writing staff between those 2 years, because maybe there's a story there. And by the way, if you know, and I mean, the odds that someone who works on the show is listening to this is pretty long, but if you happen to know anything about the departure of Thomas Gibson, we would love to hear from you, and we will treat it. We will treat it with complete anonymity. We will not reveal our sources, because for that episode and that episode alone, we will be a journalistic enterprise.
Well, it's not only that. I mean, I would be willing. I would just like to know, even for me.
For you without covering it on the show.
Just for
I know.
Me, because that was just
it was
first
her. Yeah.
Thing that in the whole 15 years, the worst thing that Criminal Minds did was get rid of Thomas Gibson.
Yeah, was losing Thomas Gibson. It broke the show. And I mean, as they say, it broke the it threw the show off a cliff, and it just took him four seasons to hit the ground. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's that. We'll see you back here next week for the first episode of Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. And like I said, after that, Beyond Borders Tuesdays, regular episodes from season 12 on Thursdays. We'll see you back here for that. Oh, and if you're listening to this on any kind of a podcast client, drop by and give us a review. I understand people think I nitpick too much from our various reviews. And I will take that on board.
Well, not always. I mean, No,
we don't have to get into that now. Don't worry.
No, not that one.
There's a good sign. There's a good sign that I haven't taken on board the criticism that I nitpicked too much, because last episode I nitpicked something Helen Keller said. So it really does seem like I have not learned that lesson yet.
What I was going to say, and then there was some guy that actually said, everybody's got to listen to this podcast. So
it's because of that. So there you go.
Well, no, I don't know. Whatever.
You understand that I'm trying to salve my, salve my ego here. You should probably just let me have that one.
Okay, I'll you have that one.
Dude. There we go. So we'll see you back here for that. But until then, I'm going to say thanks for listening and au revoir.
Have a good weekend.
Profiling Criminal Minds is a member of the Kinks Podcasting Network.